I'm Artie Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. A group of business leaders, economists, scientists, and former government officials are warning of the enormous cost that climate change is having and will continue to have on the U.S. economy if there aren't efforts to reduce CO2 emissions. They call themselves the Risky Business Project and include former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, former Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, and others. In fact, Paulson wrote recently in the New York Times that the U.S. failed to rein in the excesses of the financial markets that led to the collapse of 2008, and the country is making the same mistake with climate change. He writes, "We're staring down a climate bubble that poses enormous risks to both our environment and economy. The warning signs are clear and growing more urgent as the risks go unchecked." We invite two people involved in this project to join us on Radio Times. Kate Gordon is the executive director of the Risky Business Project. She's also vice president and director of the Energy and Climate Program at Next Generation. That's a San Francisco-based think tank. She got up early to join us on Radio Times. And Kate Gordon, nice to have you with us on the show.
It's great to be here, Marty. Thanks.
You're welcome. And also with us is Robert Kopp. He's associate professor in the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences, also the associate director of the Rutgers Energy Institute at Rutgers University. He's the lead scientist for the American Climate Prospectus, and that's the technical analysis underlying the Risky Business Project. He joins us from the studios of Harvard University. And Robert Kopp, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good to be here, Marty.
Let me begin with you, Kate. What is the message from this project, the Risky Business Project? What are these business people saying?
Well, we essentially decided to do a classic business risk assessment on climate. We took a look about 2 years ago and said, this debate is falling so easily into either a partisan hole over the fight over the science or a partisan hole over the specific policy solution, when in fact there's a need for just a straightforward risk assessment of if we don't check climate change, what kinds of risks do our businesses and our regions face at a very actionable and granular level. And the bottom line from the work that Bob and his team did so brilliantly is we don't face just one risk. We face multiple risks in multiple parts of the economy, and those risks are very specific to the regions of the country that you live in. There's not one answer to the question, but every region of the country faces significant risk from climate change.
And I want to get to all of that. But can you say, Kate Gordon, that then Hank Paulson agrees, at least with some degree, with someone like a Bill McKibben on this issue of climate change?
Well, as our risk committee, we called the high-level principles for this project our risk committee. And as they wrote in an open letter to the Wall Street Journal, they disagree in many ways on the right solutions to these problems. They have a lot of areas where they don't agree with each other on their public positioning, but they all agree that we need to take this issue seriously, and businesses in particular need to better understand those risks. So yeah, I think that they're essentially they're the common denominator that we've got to take the risks seriously and we've got to understand them. As Mayor Bloomberg always says, if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. And that's basically what we're saying here.
Well, that's where you come in, Robert Kopp. Is climate change now measurable?
Well, Marty, I think there's a number of specific risks of climate change that are measurable. There's a lot that are hard to measure. In fact, I would say actually some of the things that keep me up at night are the things that we don't know how to put a dollar value on. But there are risks you can sort of put a dollar value on. And we looked at a number of different risks using a new sort of economic modeling framework. So we looked at things like changes in labor productivity resulting because of people not being able to spend as many hours working, particularly outside, coastal damages, so changes from storm and sea level rise, more people dying because of heat-related causes, and less people dying because of cold-related causes. So we worked through a number of different sectors of that sort, but there's certainly a lot that you can't put a dollar tag on. But there, even the ones you can put a dollar tag on add up to something significant.
You work in New Jersey at Rutgers University. I mean, can we say a storm like Superstorm Sandy, as we call her, almost 2 years ago, that was a result of climate change? Can we make those comparisons or, I guess, analysis?
We can't say that Sandy itself was caused by climate change. What we can say is that Sandy occurred on top of sea levels that were about a foot higher than they were in 1900. And more than half of that foot was due to changes related to the climate. So about 7 inches. And those 7 inches caused about 70,000 additional people in New York and New Jersey to be flooded, who wouldn't have been flooded without the climate-related sea level rise. So while you can't tie that specific storm, we can say that it will take less of a storm to cause comparable flooding as we're going forward.
So sea level rise is something that is measurable and obviously has effects on coastal communities.
Absolutely.
And it is as a result of climate change?
Yes. There are a number of factors that contribute to sea level rise in any particular place, but on the global average, sea level is rising because we're putting more heat into the ocean and because glaciers and ice sheets are shrinking as we warm up the planet.
Well, let me go back to you, Kate Gordon. And something like 40% of the U.S. population lives along the coast. Is everybody vulnerable that lives along the coast?
Well, and in some regions, it's even bigger. So in the Northeast, where you are, it's 88% of the population, and about 68% of your GDP comes from those coastal counties. So as Bob said, that sea level rise, but also the combination of sea level rise and storm surge from more frequent storms, that's going to cause flooding in those coastal areas where a lot of our infrastructure is based, a lot of our energy infrastructure, our transportation infrastructure, obviously residential, commercial property. So absolutely, there is a risk to people, of course, and to the economy of these areas. I often think about the Southeast in particular, where there's a huge amount of energy infrastructure concentrated. We saw the impacts of a big flood on that energy infrastructure when Katrina hit. That's going to be an area that's very vulnerable to these kinds of climate impacts because of, you know, increased sea levels and that storm surge effect.
So how do you protect against something like that?
Well, you know, there's a combination of things. One thing we talk about a lot in the report is you can't have this artificial distinction between mitigation, that is trying to bring down your emissions to avoid future impacts, and adaptation or resilience, that is dealing with the impacts that are already here. As Bob just said, you know, the sea level rise that was there during Hurricane Sandy is the result of decisions we've been making over the last 50 years or so. Of emissions in the atmosphere, that's in the system. That's right. Something we need to react to, and we need to shore up against, so we're not just having, you know, extreme disaster relief after extreme disaster relief. But at the same time, we need to be looking ahead at the decisions we're making today and saying, okay, what are the impacts 30 years from now that we need to avoid by putting less greenhouse gases into the atmosphere? So you need to work on both things simultaneously, that resilience piece and also thinking about bringing down those emissions.
Well, the resilience piece, I guess, is putting things on stilts or creating some kind of buffer. I know the dunes, Robert Kopp, along the New Jersey coastline actually was protective against some of the storm surge of Sandy, for instance.
Yeah, that's right. If you look at the places that were damaged, in many cases, places that had chosen to invest in putting dunes there and did, in fact, do quite much better. There was one case in front of the New Jersey Supreme Court, which you may recall, I believe it was last year, with a couple suing the city that they were in for blocking their view with the dunes. But in fact, I believe their home was protected as a result of those dunes during the storm.
I think that's actually correct. Let me move on to something else. And you also, you and others, Robert Kopp, looked at agriculture, the effect of climate change on our vast farming system in the United States. What did you conclude?
Well, so we looked at four specific crops where the data was strong enough to enable us to do an analysis. So we looked at sort of what are the four major commodity crops, so cotton, wheat, soy, and corn. And what we found is that if we maintain our current agricultural practices, we could be looking at significant and increasingly large reductions in crop yield over the course of the century, particularly in the eastern half of the country where we don't tend to irrigate our crops to the same extent you do out in the west. The crops that are less are not irrigated as frequently are more sensitive to changes in heat. In fact, if you look at sort of the response of crops to temperature and the reason why this is such a large effect, to start with, if you turn up the temperature a little bit, you'll get an increase in crop yields. But there's a cliff in the response of the crop. So if you look at corn, as you go to about 86 degrees Fahrenheit, above that, every day you spend above that drives down your crop yields a lot. So we're getting a pretty large effect in the, particularly the eastern half of the country.
Is there a connection between heat and drought?
There certainly drought has an effect as well. And in fact, in the western half of the country, that's probably the greatest concern with respect to impact on agriculture. There are parts of the country that we expect to become wetter as climate change. There are other parts, such as the Southwest in California, that we expect may become drier.
Okay, go ahead.
And I was going to say, Marty, you know, I'm in California. We did not model tree nuts, the niche crops we have out here, which are a lot of tree nuts in particular and fruit. But if you look at California and the impacts that you see in the research that, that Bob and his team did, those drought conditions or their decreased water availability would have a significant impact out here. One, I found out the other day that one almond takes a gallon of water to grow.
Whoa.
So if you're in drought conditions as we are right now in California, if you lose that almond orchard, it takes you 6 years to get mature trees again. So that's a significant hit to an industry that is the backbone of California economy and just the agricultural system overall.
Kate, let me go back to you. Something else in this report is that there will be in the future more days in the 90s. Can you flesh that out a bit?
Absolutely. That I think one of the really interesting things about the way we presented the heat impacts. A lot of people look at average rising temperatures, and we figured, you know, people are actually a little more sensitive to the number of days over 95 degrees that they experience each year. So one thing that we modeled, and Bob can say more, but one thing we modeled in the paper was looking at the region's average days over 95 for each region for the last 30, 40 years, and then looking at the projection into mid-century and then late century. And there's parts of the country, this is going to hit almost every part of the country. There are parts of the country, again, like the Southeast, the Southern Great Plains, the Southwest, where you'll see up to several months of additional days over 95 degrees. And one thing we say in the report that brings this home is a summer day in Minnesota could look like a current summer day in Texas, or a summer in Minnesota on average, which is pretty significant change.
You want to add to that, Robert? We're almost up on a break, but we have about 45 seconds.
Sure. You know, certainly that looking at days over 95, we certainly can't claim credit for that as being an original way of presenting the data. But one thing we did look at, which hopefully we'll have time to talk more about later, that I think is less frequently talked about is how the changes in heat and humidity interact on those extreme days. And sort of in our projection under business as usual, there's a large part of the eastern half of the country that might have more hot, humid days than Louisiana does today by late in the century.
Well, let's take that short break, and we will pick up on that after this break. That's Robert Kopp, Associate Professor in the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences, also Associate Director of the Rutgers Energy Institute, and that's at Rutgers University. And some of his work, he's a lead scientist for the American Climate Prospectus, and some of that analysis underlying the Risky Business Project, which is what we're talking about in this hour of Radio Times. Also with us, Kate Gordon. She's the executive director of the Risky Business Project. We want to hear from you, and you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The National Constitution Center supports WHYY. The National Constitution Center is the museum of We the People, featuring the acclaimed multimedia show Freedom Rising, Signers Hall, and the story of We the People through artifacts, a rare copy of the Constitution, and interactive exhibits. Now through October 19th, Slavery at Jefferson's Monticello, a powerful exhibition that follows six enslaved families who lived and worked at Jefferson's plantation. More at 215-409-6700 or constitutioncenter.org.
Happy birthday, America. This Friday, celebrate our 238th year of independence with A Capitol Fourth from NPR Music. I'm Corva Coleman with onstage host Tom Bergeron and a huge lineup of talent, including Frankie Valli, Patti LaBelle, Michael McDonald, and more. They'll be performing live from the U.S. Capitol. Don't miss A Capitol Fourth from NPR Music.
Friday night at 8 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Compensation guru Ken Feinberg is overseeing the fund for victims of GM's defective ignition switches.
GM basically has said, Whatever it costs to pay all eligible claims, they will pay it.
We'll speak with Ken Feinberg next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking about a new report from the Risky Business Project saying that climate change is bad for business and can hurt certain segments of the economy. There's some evidence of that today. And according to the report, if things are not done to address the problem of climate change, it could get worse. And we're talking with Robert Kopp and Kate Gordon. We want to hear from you. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Robert, you wanted to flesh this heat-humidity thing out for us. Go ahead.
Sure. So if you think about what makes the feel of a summer day, it's as much the humidity as the heat. I'm from Washington, D.C. originally, and we certainly know there, you know, those days in the middle of the summer, there's currently a handful a year where it's so hot and humid that you really have to be extremely careful. You get heat warnings. Well, those sorts of days will become more common as it gets hotter, as the hotter air sort of holds more humidity. So there will be a lot more days like that. But then there will also be days that are so hot and humid that we don't really have good analogies in our experience. So there's sort of two levels of heat and humidity above those sort of heat warning days that I think many of us are familiar with.
Yep.
There's what we in the American Climate Prospectus call a Category 3 day, which is essentially like the 1995 heat wave in the Midwest. The worst days of that, you know, basically there's been nothing in the last 30 years other than the Midwest heat wave that are that hot and humid. And we expect to see, you know, start to see up to a couple weeks like that a year under business as usual by late in the century in much of the eastern half of the country. And then we could also start to see days that are so hot and humid that essentially you can't really go outside without and do anything significant without risking raising your body temperature to the point where you get heat stroke. Those sorts of days, that's a real risk of climate change. It's not something, you know, it's not something that's going to happen every day or every year. But as we get towards the end of the century, and particularly if we continue on sort of a fossil fuel intensive path into the 22nd century, you could start to see more and more days like this that are such extraordinarily dangerous days where you're dependent upon air conditioning for habitability.
Well, and I'm thinking about people who have to work outside, whether it's construction workers or farm yeah. workers. I mean, you're talking about people that are potentially putting their health at risk working in these conditions.
Right. Well, even today, even just thinking about what we call the Category 2 days, sort of the heat warning days, right? On days like that, which are, you know, a few days a year in, say, D.C. and Philadelphia right now, certainly you want to get construction workers and people like that in the shade, not working during the peak of the day. And you will expect to see a lot more of that going forward. And one of the that relates to one of the largest economic impacts we looked at, which is this loss in labor productivity, because there are sectors of the economy where people just can't work as many hours if it's hotter out.
Kate Gordon, we lost you temporarily. I believe we have you back.
I'm back.
Okay, very good. Oh, I love technology. all this, I mean, I was talking with Robert Kopp about this heat humidity business and the issue of rising temperatures, which seems to me also puts more pressure on the electrical grid. People are going to want, you know, more and more availability of air conditioning, for instance.
That's right. One of the things that the project points out is this increase in demand for electricity, which is correspondent, as you said, to this increase in demand for air conditioning. And that increase in demand leads to, it's actually a combination of things. There's an increase in demand, but then the hot weather also makes our existing power plants and energy infrastructure less efficient. Mm. So a power plant needs a lot of help being cooled down. If you think about cooling towers on nuclear facilities, or you just think about all the water that coal plants use to cool down, that's a lot of extra cooling that they need, so their capacity is down. They need more work to cool down. And the transmission lines, as they get hotter, get less effective in transmitting electrons. So you have sort of a less effective system and more demand for the system. And actually, in the work that we did on the project, we actually find that by mid-century, that's not even that far long from now, that by mid-century, given all the increase in energy demands, we could be looking at a need for about 95 gigawatts of additional power capacity, which is about 200 average coal plants, let's say, or natural gas plants. So we don't need to do that necessarily with coal or natural gas, but we need to do it. We're going to need to do it by mid-century to meet all that new demand.
Which raises the question about what do if all this is sort of half baked in the system, and there are some things we can do. Perhaps I'll put this first to you, Kate, and then to you, Robert, which is looking at things like coal fire power plants. I believe in Pennsylvania, something like 40% of our energy comes from coal fire power plants. What do we do about that?
Well, Robert's well positioned to answer on the science, but let me just say two things. One is, you know, one of the things I was most struck by all of the work that we did on this project was these heat impacts we're talking about are preventable to a great extent. I mean, you know, I was talking about the sea level rise being baked in a little bit, but the heat impacts that Robert and I have been talking about over the next century, we can avoid those through bringing down emissions. So that's just, we got to keep remembering that. This is not a path we have to be on. This is the path we modeled, but it's not inevitable.
Right.
The other thing is in terms of energy, the other hat that I wear is an energy policy hat. And you're absolutely right. I mean, getting to a more diversified energy system, doing more renewable energy, which both brings down emissions and sort of spreads out power so you don't have these huge long transmission lines, those things are all going to be positive in terms of both adapting to the situation and helping to mitigate it.
Robert, do you want to weigh in on that?
Sure. I think it's important when we think about what to do, we realize that there are risks that we've already baked in and ones that we have and therefore have to adapt to, and ones that we can sort of cut off by reducing our greenhouse gas emissions. So we look at the focus in the report on three different time periods. The first earliest time period is our 2020 to 2039. Then we look at the middle of the century and the late end of the century. And basically, the impacts we see sort of in the next 20 years or so really are already baked in. So as we figure out what to do with our emissions, we have to understand that, you know, we're not going to see the benefits of those emissions reductions until about the middle of the century. Mm. But then we'd still start seeing increasingly large differences between the paths that we could be on. And there's one other point. You know, we've talked about this as a risk assessment, but we haven't really talked about risk as a concept yet. And I think one thing important to keep in mind is that we're trying to characterize the risks. We're not just trying to characterize what's most likely to happen, but also, you know, so what's the 1 in 20 chance, worst case, that might happen? And it's particularly, you know, those 1 in 20 chance, worst case, where I think we get the most leverage from reducing our greenhouse gas emissions. The worst case, if we're in sort of middle or late of the century, if we're on a business as usual emissions trajectory, is a lot worse than the worst case if we significantly reduce our emissions.
Kate, let me go back to you, and I'm sort of stuck on this this coal part of the formula, only because there's so much pressure now to, and the EPA is looking at putting some more controls over coal fire power plants. And you think of a state like West Virginia. I mean, these are jobs; these are people that work in the mines, whether we like it or not. If we're talking about the effect of climate change on the U.S. economy, if we were to get rid of coal, those people would lose their jobs. Wouldn't that affect their economy in West Virginia?
You know, it's a great question. We obviously didn't model out any of these solutions in this project, but it's absolutely right that the risks that we're talking about here are a particular set of risks from climate change. There's a whole other set of risks that might be inherent to some of the solutions that we might put forward, as well as a set of benefits. So you point out quite rightly that the miners in West Virginia may suffer economic harm if we shut down coal. I should point out, actually, about the miners in West Virginia that Their ranks have been decimated, not by the EPA rule, but by the switch to mountaintop mining from traditional mining, which is a far less labor-intensive process and uses more machines. So that's really what's hit them. But you're right that there may be impacts. And I think what's important to look at is the range of potential risks. So that heat and humidity issue that Robert was talking about, miners are an outdoor worker, are a place that there's a lot of outdoor workers, and they're one of the most hard hit from those heat impacts. West Virginia has 30% of its workforce in outdoor high-risk occupations when it comes to heat. So there's a lot of different risks to weigh in all these decisions. And really what we're saying with this project is people making those long-term investments in our economy and our energy system need to weigh all those risks. We can't overweight some economic risks without looking at the full picture.
And that's Kate Gordon. She's the executive director of the Risky Business Project. Also with us, Robert Kopp, associate professor in the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences and associate director of the Rutgers Energy Institute. That's at Rutgers University. We are talking about this report from the Risky Business Project, looking at the effect of climate change on property, on farmland, on productivity, on energy, and on health. We want to hear from you. What do you think about what we're talking about? The email is radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Robert, I can imagine I'm feeling this to some degree myself. I'm listening to the two of you and thinking all is lost.
Well,
honestly,
I have to say, in my experience, I certainly have some more senior colleagues who do feel that way. I don't. I think there's a lot we still can do. And I think what I was saying earlier, you know, there is stuff we will have to adapt to. There's no questions. We've changed the shape of the climate for the next 20 or 30 years. But beyond that, there's a lot of leverage in reducing our greenhouse gas emissions. And even for the stuff we've already baked into the system, part of that we can't adapt to, but part of it we can. I talked about these extreme, this is more of a mitigation question, but I talked about the extreme heat and humidity days, right? There's a huge difference between business as usual and even moderate mitigation if you look at sort of the end of the century in terms of how many days of extreme heat and humidity.
In fact, I'm looking at something that you, a description of your, some of the work that you've done, and you say that human civilization has become a geological force.
Yeah, and indeed, that's sort of what's led me to the particular career path that I'm on. I started out studying sort of long-term evolution of life and climate over billions of years. My thesis work was on something called Snowball Earth 2.5 billion years ago, when it may have been cyanobacteria or blue-green algae that caused a global climate catastrophe.
Oh.
But I sort of moved into, post-grad school, I've sort of moved into more this realm at sort of the intersection of policy and earth science, because I think the main challenge we face as a civilization in the century is the fact that we are reshaping so many of the planet of the earth elements of the earth system, not just the climate, but also the biosphere, nitrogen and phosphorus cycles. And all of these are because we've gotten the sort of technological power and the population size to get a lot of leverage on the earth. And I think that is sort of a big challenge, but I think it's also, a challenge we can overcome.
And Kate, do you think there's a technological solution? I mean, if technology is part of the problem, is it also part of the solution?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to have to be to an extent. I mean, it's interesting. I think a lot of people, when they find out I work on climate change, say, aren't you just depressed all the time? And I mean, I'm actually pretty optimistic. It's interesting. One of the reasons that we even took this risk approach in the first place was we started thinking about the fact that we take a risk approach in all kinds of very scary things in the business community. We do it with war and terrorism. We do classic risk analysis about that and about extreme weather events and other issues. And that doesn't mean that we're giving up. It means that we're trying to operationalize those risks into our everyday decision makings, get our head around them, get our hands around them, and actually take action to reduce our risks and to deal with them. I think the American business community in particular is very good at that. We're risk takers, but we're thoughtful risk takers, and we generally have very, very innovative and entrepreneurial business folks and people in the public sector who take this stuff on. My concern has always been we're not acknowledging that those risks exist, and we're not acknowledging that we need to kind of get our hands around it and get, you know, have a new Apollo project, if you will, and really do something about this. But I have a lot of hope.
Well, we have an email from Alan. What do you say to obstinate climate change deniers? How do you start a reasonable dialogue? And Kate, again, I guess I'll toss that to you. And what's interesting is we've got people like Henry Paulson last summer, four EPA administrators who worked for four Republican administrations, talked about some of what we're talking about. And I wonder if there's a shift, but also, is it possible to have a reasonable dialogue?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it goes back to the first point I made, which was that one thing we tried to do with this project was not to start a fight over the science. It's been interesting in talking to people about the project and people who might even put themselves in a denier camp. One of the things I've realized is that we shut down the conversation immediately if we start talking about who's to blame for climate change. If you make it a conversation about blame, it's very, very hard to move from there to a productive dialogue. If you make it a conversation about a specific big government policy response, it's very hard to move from there to a conversation. But if you start with, let's look at your individual region and even down to the county level, let's talk about these particular risks. Let's talk about the fact that we do risk assessment all the time and that this is, you know, how you react to this risk depends on your risk tolerance, but at least let's talk about what the situation is and how we might want to get our hands around it. I think that's an opening to a conversation with a far broader set of people than we've had before.
Robert Kopp, do you think there are some parts of the country, and we're talking pretty specifically about the United States, that would benefit from climate change?
Well, there's a possibility, if you look only at the impacts that we looked at and quantified in this report, that some of the northernmost parts of the country might. If you look at particularly places like Oregon and Washington, we are projecting that in the most likely case, although not in the worst case, they might actually see more reductions in deaths from less cold than they do in terms of increased deaths from more heat. So there are some examples like that. But certainly if you look at the nation as a whole, it's almost certainly a negative impact. And even if there are some states that might locally benefit, they're not cut off from the national economy. So one of the things we found when we put all of our work into a national economic model is that, in fact, if you think about the coastal damage, if you think about sort of the destruction of property and infrastructure that we saw in events like Sandy, that actually propagates through the whole national economy and ends up, because of its effect on capital markets, causing more damage than just the direct damage. So if you were to take bits of the country in isolation, it might be possible, but no state is not really, well, obviously Hawaii is an island, but other than Hawaii,
no state is an island.
Hawaii
is probably the most dependent state of all the states on the mainland. So it's an island, but it's a very interdependent island.
And is it an island, Robert Kopp, and we're almost up in a break here, that's seeing sea level rise?
Absolutely. You know, all of the coastal areas are impacted by sea level rise. We happen to be sitting in the region that might see the largest increase in property damage from sea level rise, as like New York, New Jersey, Delaware, in terms of percentage increase. But all of our coastal areas are going to be threatened by sea level rise.
Well, we're talking about a report from the Risky Business Project looking at the economic, business, financial impacts of climate change. That's Robert Kopp. Also with us, Kate Gordon. And we're taking emails, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. What do you think should be done about it? Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY comes from the new Wells Fargo Propel World American Express card, designed to bring the world within reach for Wells Fargo customers. Details at a local Philadelphia area branch or wellsfargo.com/propel. Wells Fargo, the world is open. Keep exploring.
Most of the fish we eat in the U.S. is imported, yet much of the fish we catch here is exported. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Paul Greenberg about this seafood deficit and its implications for our health and the health of our economy and the oceans. Greenberg is the author of American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood. Join us.
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Drill for oil and find a gusher in your backyard, and in the old days, you're suddenly rich. Find natural gas in the rock below your driveway, and New York State's highest court now says it's okay to ban oil and gas production within the state's borders due to the controversy over fracking in New York. Start spreading the news. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Bad energy habits around the office can affect your bottom line. PICO Smart Ideas for Your Business can help with customized tips, information, and programs designed to save you energy and money. Learn more at PICO.com/smartideas. PICO supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe. And just to recap, a bipartisan group of business leaders and economists, scientists, and former government officials are warning of the enormous cost that climate change will have on the U.S. economy. The Risky Business Project includes former Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, Michael Bloomberg, former mayor of New York City, and they released a report quantifying the economic toll that things like stronger storms and higher seas and heat waves and droughts will have, and they are pressing for action. Talking with Kate Gordon, executive director of the Risky Business Project, and with Robert Kopp from Rutgers University, and we're taking emails at radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We do have an email wondering about using things like renewable energies, like I can't read because I can't see anymore because I'm so old. Tidal and geothermal energies, but the idea of, isn't it time to really invest more, I guess, more overtly into renewable energies? And I'll toss that first to you, Kate.
Yeah, no, I'm a big fan of sort of solutions that are both resilient and help us bring down greenhouse gas emissions. I mean, if what we need to do is get our emissions down to get off this path that we're on that Bob modeled, and we also need to be resilient to changes already that are already baked in, the best way to do that is honestly to plan for both simultaneously. Renewables are a great way to do that. So you think about this increase in energy demand, let's plan ahead to meet that increase in energy demand from rising heat. Let's plan to do it with technology that uses less, that produces less greenhouse gas emissions. That does two things simultaneously. It gives you new technology to adapt to the changing situation, and it also gives you technology that brings down those emissions. So absolutely, renewables, I mean, from wind, water, sun, there are all kinds of different things. It's like climate change. It's extremely regional. What will work for you is extremely local. But there's another benefit to that, which is the more you do distributed energy, so the more you're moving away from the centralized power plant and toward more distributed generation, the less you have these problems with like heat impacts on transmission lines. So there are a bunch of co-benefits too.
Well, Robert Kopp, we've done, as you can imagine, you know, many shows about natural gas because of Marcellus Shale. And of course, that has meant some real jobs here in Pennsylvania. Do you see natural gas as a kind of a bridge fuel? If the idea is to wean ourselves from fossil fuels for economic and environmental reasons, what role do you think natural gas plays?
Okay, so I'm going to take off my hat as lead scientist for this project for a moment and put on my hat as associate director of the Rutgers Energy Institute.
Fair enough.
So that I have the freedom to opine on this. So I think if you
opine away, yes, go ahead.
At natural gas, I mean, it is a significant factor driving the reductions in carbon dioxide emissions we've seen in the U.S. over the last few years. I think if done correctly, I think it has potential to be a bridge fuel, but it's going to be a fairly short bridge. If you look at sort of what our middle or moderate emissions trajectory course that we looked at requires, you basically, by the middle of the century, have to be getting away from fossil fuels if you're not capturing and burying the carbon. So one interesting thing to research might be to improve ways of capturing carbon from natural gas power plants. Most of the work in that area has been focused on coal. I think the other thing that certainly is very familiar to you all in Pennsylvania that is a real risk associated with natural gas is the fact that you're bringing industrialization in many ways to areas that haven't seen it before. So you're bringing the habitat fragmentation and the roads and all of the costs and benefits associated with that. So there's both local environmental impacts and this global effect. And the global effect, if you control leakage, is probably positive in the short term, mm-hmm. as long as you are doing it away so that you're away from it in relatively short order.
Kate, I was reading something recently. I think I saw it in the New York Times. It was a NASA time lapse, excuse me, and it looked at, I believe it was the East Coast of the United States, and it saw a pretty dramatic reduction in nitrogen dioxide. Mm-hmm. And part of the study, or at least part of this report, said this was as a result of regulation. And you know, regulation has become a bad word for a number of people. But do you see the role of regulation in trying to reduce the effects of CO2 emissions?
This is I'll take off my hat too on Risky Business, because we deliberately did not put forward specific solutions because of our group of high level principles. We didn't want to go there with that group. But just personally, and in my own life in energy policy, there is of course a role for regulation. You see it in a lot of different areas. One of them you just talked about. One is obviously regulating pollutants from power plants. Another is just simple regulations like building codes, which have been extremely effective in bringing down, in getting us energy efficiency and bringing down emissions. I think Bob brings up an incredibly good point, though, and it's one that really struck me with our project, which is that there's one of the challenges of working on climate change is that a lot of the impacts are extremely local, and then the issue itself of carbon emissions is extremely global. So we talk a lot in the report about local impacts from climate change down to the county level. Bob was just talking about local impacts from fracking, but it is true that at a global level, natural gas, you know, has brought down U.S. carbon emissions. At a global level, we're going to have to deal with this climate change issue. So how to reconcile that local impact global goal is very, very challenging.
Well, I don't know which hat you all are going to have to wear, because we have an email from Nancy, and she thinks that population increase must have a huge effect. Why does no one want to talk about this? Do you want to talk about this, Robert Kopp?
Sure, I'm happy to. So one of the things the climate science community does is come up with scenarios for sort of what might happen in the future in terms of demographic and socioeconomics. And indeed, you do see a wide range of differences in projections of future population growth. If the economy were to grow at the same rate and you were to double the number of people on the planet, economic productivity were going to grow at the same rate and you double the number of people on the planet, you'd basically double the amount of greenhouse gas emissions. And so that's a fairly significant effect. On the other hand, if you look at sort of the five scenarios the climate modeling community has come up with to span the space of sort of what might happen with the economy and what might happen with the population, it turns out that actually the pathway that has the largest emissions isn't the one with the fastest population growth. It's the one with the fastest economic growth in the absence of any movement in the technology away from fossil fuels. So if the entire world converges onto a U.S. European standard of living quickly, but the population stays at its current level, that has a larger set of emissions than if that convergence is slower, or that convergence happens as you're transitioning away from fossil fuels. So it's a mixture. All of these play a role.
Kate, to you, do businesses, and we're speaking broadly here, do they need Congress to enact changes that would help to mitigate some of what we've been talking about?
Well, you know, I think there's a lot that business can do as business. So to start there, you know, one thing we call for in this project and we will keep calling for and keep talking about is anyone making long-term capital investments, whether that's private sector or public sector, making those investments, investing in others that are making those investments, needs to take these risks into account. So whether you're a bond rater or a bond issuer for a city, whether you're a utility doing power plant investments, whether you're doing long-term real estate investments. The public sector needs to do this with its own infrastructure investments. Those need to take climate risk into effect. And doing that will actually, we think, have a big impact on resilience and also people starting to think about mitigation. But are there limits to that private sector action? In some cases, sure. I mean, in some of the sectors we looked at, we are going to need some public sector action. Let me talk about insurance for one thing.
Yeah.
The insurance sector is long-term thinking, and they've noticed climate change and therefore gotten out of the business of flood insurance in a lot of Florida, for instance. Who picked up the tab for that flood insurance? The federal government. So taking away people's ability to do actual risk assessment and just removing the cost of those risks is changing the way people behave, and I think it's probably not a good role for the federal government. We should be, as a society and as a government, stepping up and saying this is a real set of risks. Mm. Let's take a look at what we need to do to make the right kinds of choices, and ultimately that is going to mean carbon emission reductions.
But, you know, whenever there's a flood or some kind of a natural disaster, who do people call? They call the federal government.
Exactly, and that's something that's really struck me. I mean, the irony to some extent, there's a lot of fear, which I understand, that reaction to climate change will mean some kind of a big government solution. But in a way, that's sort of ironic, because if you look at how we manage climate change today, we manage it through two things, through cities taking on the burden of doing resilience and infrastructure planning. So cities basically building up these seawalls and other very expensive pieces of infrastructure. And then we do it through disaster relief, which is a federal government program. So it's a big government program already if we do nothing.
Robert Kappa, we have an email from Mike, and he's saying, you know, nuclear is really our only saving grace. You can't power a big economy like the U.S. economy on renewables. Yes? No?
I think nuclear is part of the solution, but the fact is there's no silver bullet solution. We don't have a lot of new, in fact, we don't have any new nuclear power plants in this country. We're still struggling to build some new ones after last ones were built in the 1970s. So it's not clear that nuclear is the solution. On the other hand, the costs of solar has fallen dramatically. Renewables like solar and winds do have a problem in that the sun isn't always shining and the wind mm-hmm. isn't always blowing. And our solution to that at the moment is to use natural gas and to use nuclear power to provide more reliable power sources. But there's also a lot of research in how we store that energy in an efficient manner. That's research that's sort of making things like electric vehicles possible, but it's also research that's important if we want to scale things up to a grid level. And in fact, that's an area we have a number of faculty at Rutgers working on right now.
I mean, this is infrastructure, right?
It's both infrastructure and technology. One of the things about solar and wind storage is that you can move towards a more decentralized fashion. And so the question is where you put that boundary between, say, solar panels on my houses connected to solar panels on my neighbor's houses and infrastructure and so sorts of mega grid. But yeah, certainly infrastructure at some level.
Kate, you might have to not put on your risky business hat for this question. And this has to do with the Keystone Pipeline. And of course, there's a lot of focus and energy around this, if I can say that, proposal. Do you think there's too much focus on Keystone as if it's sort of the make or break when it comes to the environment versus the economy?
Big question. I guess all I'll say in relation to Keystone is, you know, on our project that we're doing, the Risky Business Project was aimed extremely specifically at the business and financial sector. There are a ton of other efforts going on around the climate change issue that have different audiences than that. And one thing that has been very successful with the Keystone Pipeline conversation has been the ability to rally particularly a lot of young people and a lot of people in parts of the country that had not been particularly active on the issue before, like in Nebraska. I mean, the ranching community. So I think that as an organizing tactic, it's been extremely successful. I think it comes back to this point I was making before, which is when we're making these big, expensive, long-term infrastructure decisions, we do need to take climate risk into effect. And I would say that for the Keystone Pipeline along with every other big infrastructure decision.
Robert Kappa, what do you want the business community then to take away from this report, this analysis?
Sure. What I would have them take away is that basically there are risks. There are real risks. Some of them we can quantify. Some of them we can't. But if you're a responsible business person, these risks could be material to your business, and it's worth taking into account. The same is true in policymaking. We want to, you know, when we think about writing regulations or designing policy, the climate change risks are real risks, and they should be taken into account. Not all of them are ones that we can put a price tag on readily. There's risks associated with potential for ecological collapse, for instance, that are very hard to value but could profoundly affect humanity. And all of these are, you know, what we would like is to get sort of climate change out of the box of a sustainability issue and in the box of, or out of, you know, in the nervous system.
Which box are we talking about? Yeah.
Yes. In the nervous system of the decision-making process.
Right. Yeah. We often say we want it to be part of the DNA of all the business and public sector decision-making. I think that's exactly right. Every single investment, and particularly long-term capital investment, whether it's made by the government, local, federal, whether it's made by business sector investors, needs to be taking this risk into account, just as they take a host of other risks into account. This is a mainstream business issue. It is not confined to the sustainability office of a big corporation. It is a mainstream issue, and we think it needs to be that, and that ultimately that will lead to the mainstream business community seeing the limits of their own ability to adapt and making it an issue for the public sector.
Is the clock ticking on this, though, Kate? We're almost out of time.
We're almost out of time.
Yeah,
that's right.
Exactly.
In every sense possible.
Exactly.
You know, the most recent IPCC report said we have about 10 to 15 years to act on mitigation, so bringing down emissions globally, getting on that different path. I think the clock is ticking, but I think that that it's ticking even faster than that. Decisions we're making today in boardrooms are affecting what these risks look like for the next 20, 30, 40 years. So we need to be starting to think this through now.
Well, Kate Gordon, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
And she's the executive director of the Risky Business Project, also vice president and director of the Energy and Climate Program at Next Generation. That's a San Francisco-based think tank. Robert Cobb, thank you very much as well.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Associate Professor in the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences, also Associate Director of the Rutgers Energy Institute at Rutgers University. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can send us an email, you can check us out on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscoe, and thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.